Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Elizabeth Margulis. She's a professor of music and director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. And we're talking about her book, Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. Wow. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I was totally intrigued just by the title.
Oh, wonderful.
And so I had to read the book. This is a book about exactly what it says. All the forms, this is a quote from the book, all the forms of connection, cognition, and imagination that music makes possible. But it also seems like some of the most difficult behaviors or experiences to explore scientifically. And you write that, you get that a lot. A lot of people will just tell you, you can't do this. You can't analyze music like that.
That's right. In fact, it's exactly that kind of intertwining of the elusive and subjective and culturally situated, and then these tools that we have from the behavioral sciences that I find such an exciting and fertile place to work.
Now, why musical daydreams? What attracted you to that region of study of cognition? I want to mention, there's a story that you start to tell in the book about you in the backseat of a car.
Yeah.
But then you left out the details.
Oh, come on.
I'm just kidding. But that was so classic. So talk
so
about that.
So mortifying still so many years later.
See, isn't it amazing?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, I had an experience in a gym, right, as an adult, where, you know, they just play kind of hype-up music in the background. And I was just doing my thing, working out. And a song came on, and I just felt wash over me an incredible, mortifying sense of shame. And I was no longer, like, I was in this gym where there was chalk all over my fingers and heavy bars. Those seemed to disappear. And, yeah, I remember what my body felt like as a middle schooler, kind of tucked in the back of this station wagon with my friends. We were on a scavenger hunt for someone's birthday party. I felt so cool that I'd been invited to this. It was a co-ed party that felt very cool to me. This same song, it turns out, had been on the radio at that time when I, feeling really included and mature and teenager-y, had used my first swear word, because I think maybe something you have to understand about me is that I was raised incredibly goody-two-shoes Catholic child, okay, leading into this experience. Did that, and it was immediately clear from the moment that I said it that no one was buying it, and it did not come out naturally, and I was neither giving the impression of being a teenager nor of being cool.
Elizabeth, you have to give out the song.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's Poison, and it's Every Rose Has Its Thorn.
Oh, my God, Elizabeth. Now, let me talk to you about, ask you some questions about this reverie that you were going through. Sure. Was it visual? Was it tactile? What was going on? Or was it a combination of all things?
Right. That's the thing. It truly was all of these things. So rather than sort of a distant memory, it felt quite like a reliving. Like this is where this title of Transported comes from. This sense that you kind of re-enter the subjective experience that you might have had in the past, or some simulation of an experience that you haven't really had.
Okay, let's start out. Is there a clear definition of musical daydream?
Yes. So for when I use the word musical daydream in the book, I'm talking about any experience you have when you listen to music and something comes to mind that is not like a fact about the music, right? You're not like, oh, that, you know, beat is a triple meter or something like that. But you're really having some sensory experience, like picturing something, imagining something, smelling something, and it ends up typically being related to the music in some way that you might not be aware of. So you might think your mind is off wandering in some inscrutable domain. And in fact, that kind of one of the things we've discovered in our research is that the music really seems to be carrying you there in really interesting ways.
So just to be clear, the musical daydream is not a memory in the traditional sense. Anybody can look at a past event and recall it in their mind. This is different. This is more vivid.
Yeah, there's a certain vividness here. Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that has really intrigued people about music. And there's been a series of studies, as I talk about in the book, where people have kind of pit music as a cue against other kinds of memory triggers. So kind of whenever I talk about this, people tend to think about Proust's Madeleine, right?
Right. Yeah, Le Recherche de Temps Perdu, yeah.
Exactly, or a smell. And I think what we see in the literature is that music really, even more than some of these other cues that we might reflexively think effectively trigger vivid memories, music really has some special ability there.
So Marcel Proust's Madeleine is the same thing, but not as intense. In other words, it's difference in intensity, not difference in kind.
Also, part of it is the way that music is extended in time. So, right, if you like take a bite of something, so that's a limited, you know, several second kind of experience, right? When you're listening to a song, it just kind of carries you along in this kind of temporally extended way that can make for some more elaborate kind of immersive recollections and imaginings.
So there's robust evidence, you write this in the book, that music can cue rich autobiographical memories. And it's music more than anything else, but it also seems to be associated with a certain time period in a person's life.
That's right. So, you know, whether this is and for most people, I will say this is generally a positive thing. So the fact that I have this highly negatively valenced, like, thing about middle school scavenger hunt is, you know, somewhat unusual. But yes, there's a reminiscence bump that's really well documented for music from people's adolescence. So this means, you know, you continue through your decades aging and, you know, becoming better and more wonderful. And it tends to be the music that you listen to when you were in high school that you tend to continue enjoying the most and that you have the most personal memories associated with. And then there's a fun little secondary reminiscence bump for music from when your parents were adolescents. So that's kind
of a phenomenon. So how would that transfer to the person? Because you haven't been born yet, right?
Exactly. It seems like it makes no sense. But what is going on?
Are you saying it's in the DNA?
No. Okay. But what I'm saying is that when you are a tiny person and you don't have agency over what you listen to, your parents.
Okay. That's, you know, that makes more sense.
By their own reminiscence bump, that's what they're playing, and then you end up having that exposure-driven preference.
Yeah, I can remember almost everything my mother and my father listened to when I was a really wee tyke.
And do when you listen to that music, can you think of things, like, often for me, it's the floor, because the floor was the thing that you could see best, right, when you were small. Like.
That's really, now, being, I'm also a rock DJ, I would argue that if you have a life in music like that, you could have a whole series of these things all the way down to the present day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if you've attended a lot of concerts. I think that's different.
Yes, that adds a whole other level. And that's one kind of interesting direction that the book goes in, is thinking about the way that these patterns and associations get established depends so much on experiencing music in these real embodied ways in the world, right? Like that you're out in the world doing things and having experiences. And live concerts are just a huge part of that. And, you know, it's part of an explanation for why it's so important to a satisfying music going life. To go be having live experiences with other people listening to music and not just by yourself over headphones.
Now, one of the things I thought of reading your book is that raves where music is really transporting a whole group of people at the same time. Is that similar? Is that within the realm of what you're concerned with your research? The kind of experiences that ravers have. And it's something's going on, and there's a lot of physicality to it too. But I often wonder if you were to ask them about their memories of it or to play certain music, whether that would cue that kind of experience.
I love that. And in fact, when people in the field overall, myself as well as my colleagues, have thought about topics like peak experiences.
Yeah,
music.
Yeah.
So there's this psychologist called Alf Gabrielsen who just went around and asked a bunch of people to describe their strongest experiences that they've ever had of music. And many of the descriptions went into some direction around kind of trancing or a sense that you've kind of extended beyond your physical body.
Out-of-body experiences.
With the music. Exactly.
Yeah.
And one kind of key assumption I have that underlies a lot of the book is that those really exceptional musical experiences are different not in kind but in degree from the kinds of everyday musical pleasures that we have, and that there's these kind of mini transportive experiences that characterize a lot of what we might think about as just kind of ordinary listening.
Now, that leads us into the next area that I want to talk about. We were talking about how music can trigger vivid memories, sensory memories of the past, but music can also trigger vivid fantasies of things that you did not participate in. And you did some really interesting research about playing certain types of music to certain groups of people and then eliciting what they was going through their mind when they were listening to it. Can you explain that?
Yes. And people thought that this was kind of a crazy research design because, we gave people a really open-ended task, which is we played them these excerpts that we had carefully arranged so that they were unlikely to have heard it before, and just asked them to freely describe what they imagined while listening. And that just seems like a terrible idea because what you would expect to get are a whole bunch of really idiosyncratic, responses. And that's not what we saw at all.
So this weirds me. When I read this in the book, this really I found strange because the first thing you started realizing realizing when you were going over the responses, there was all these pirate things.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. That was exactly my, I actually didn't believe it. At first, it was so strange to me that given, you could imagine anything, just anything, right? And people kept coming back to these, in this one case, this one excerpt, pirates battling a storm at sea. I'd been trained as a classical pianist at a conservatory. I was not thinking in this way. So this was very surprising to me. And we ended up running this study in all these different locations and in all these different ways where it got increasingly elevating the bar where, we really wanted to have evidence to believe that people were spontaneously imagining the same thing to the same excerpt. And, just saw this coming out again and again. So it's one of these findings that is on the knife edge between intuitive and, very strange, and we kept kind of going back and forth and trying to understand. And one thing we did to try to make sense of it was, look at responses in different parts of the U.S.
And then you went to China to a fairly isolated community, Dimen, China.
Yes, exactly.
And you did get different. And you did get different responses.
We did, yeah. And what was interesting there is that. Responses people in that community gave were as tightly clustered with one another, but entirely different from what we were seeing from the participants in the U.S. And so this is where we start to see that this is something that it seems like people do quite naturally in a variety of kinds of circumstances. But the kinds of associations people have to, you know, whatever sound patterns are really dependent on the kind of exposure that they've had growing up in a particular community. And so it's on the one hand something that can be broadly shared in all these interesting ways, and in another sense, something that can diverge in really illuminating, interesting ways too.
So does it have to do with the quality of the music seems to trigger certain kinds of fantasies?
But you know, that's such a good question. And we actually have not seen, I mean, I'm sure that kind of what we might think about as quality could vary, right, between.
Well, different tones.
Yeah, but what we do see is this same kind of response emerging to lots of different music and lots of different genres. Now, there are certain kinds, like this is an interesting question, is what kinds of music tend to be the best memory triggers? What kind of music tend to be the most story triggers?
Of music that the people have never heard of before.
Exactly. Okay. Of things people have never heard of before. Exactly. Okay. And so for the memory trigger, it seems to be that when, even if you don't know a song, if it sounds like something that you heard a lot during your adolescence, it can end up being a pretty powerful memory cue, even though it's new. And on the story front, one of the things we're seeing is that when the music does a lot of things that are unexpected in various ways, so maybe it starts off really quiet and tentative, and then there's like, you know, some really huge chord comes in, that seems to want to draw out a narrative, a gentle kind of interpretation from a listener. Like, it feels like the only way to explain, you know, what happened is in some kind of quasi-story-like way. So those are two kinds of trends that we've noticed across genres.
Well, for the benefit of the listeners, I want to mention that there's a lot of research that you cite in this book, and we can't possibly do justice to it. But there's so many threads that I really became fascinated by. At one point, you mentioned people who have synesthesia, people who hear colors and stuff like that. And then you mentioned aphantics. Who are aphantics?
Yes. So people with aphantasia, there's been quite a bit of coverage of this in the news recently. So this might seem familiar.
It was in the New York Times just last week, I think.
Oh, I see. Oh, I didn't see that. So people with aphantasia seem to have a different, duller, maybe absent mind's eye than most of us. So,
right, they have no visual. They have no visual, like when you ask them, imagine a candle, they can't do it.
Yeah. So you and I might see like wax dripping down the side of it, right, and the flickering of the candle, and this visual imagining that kind of seems to come along automatically for many people. Really seems not to be present for people with aphantasia. And then, you know, how that becomes interesting in terms of all the stuff in the book is, you know, what is it like to have these kinds of musical daydreams when the visual component is not present at all? Because, you know, one of the things we really do see is a preponderance of visual imagery in these experiences.
So do aphantics have musical daydreams?
So there's lots of research going on about that right now. So I would say that's like a TBD.
Okay. What about synesthetes? Do synesthetes have weird musical daydreams?
Yes, there is actually a researcher at the University of Durham in the UK called Caroline Kerwin, who is studying musical daydreams in people with synesthesia at this moment. So that there's also lots of interesting stuff happening there. For me, you know, this reminds me a little bit about what happened in our field 20 years ago, maybe, where earworms.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
People turned their attention to earworms. I think before that, we had kind of assumed that earworms were kind of a weird thing that sometimes happened, but maybe not that regularly. And then when, you know, we started actually studying it, it became clear that this was a completely ubiquitous occurrence and like super common and could actually tell us interesting things about the human mind. And for me, daydreams are something, musical daydreams are something similar, where we've just kind of brushed them aside and not, you know, put them in the center of our focus previously. And that just the very act of doing that is kind of generating these new questions and allowing us new insights. And my hope is also that just helping people engage with their own listening practices in ways that, you know, connect them more to each other and to what music is capable of.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Elizabeth Margulis. Thank you. She's professor of music and director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. And we're talking about her book, Transported, The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. You also write in a section of the book about how we have a tendency to find visual analogies to the sounds that we're listening to. I think it's the chapter Beethoven and Crocodiles, where certain kinds of tones elicit certain visual responses in different cultures.
Yes. So if we think about even the way we try to describe what's going on in the music we're listening to, it feels really natural to say, you know, that note is a high, right? That's a low note. But of course, that's actually a visual metaphor, right? There's nothing intrinsically like vertically higher or lower than anything else, except for maybe if you think about it in staff notation or something like that. So there's this metaphor that is operating kind of at the very heart of how we describe even really basic elements of sound. But one of the things that's interesting is that that is not necessarily the same mapping that is used in all languages and all places. There's a whole fascinating range of descriptions people use, ranging from thin and thick to light and heavy.
Right.
And kind of one of the interesting things is, like, even if you're in a language like we are, where high and low is very common, if I ask you whether you think, you know, light or high notes are light or heavy, like, what do you think?
You'd say light.
Yeah, you'd say high note would be light. Exactly. Yeah. So there's this clustering of these axes, of these different dimensions along which people describe sound in visual terms. And that seems to kind of tell us something about kind of a robust internal mapping we have about how all of these dimensions relate to one another. And, you know, that all may seem like a little abstract. It's like, okay, that's this one dimension. But it does seem to play into these kind of larger, more dramatic, I'm in the back of a station wagon type of
You keep going back to that, Elizabeth.
You know, some things are hard to get over.
I guess so. You're fascinated by new technology, too. And you write a lot about stuff that we're finding out about fantasies occurring in the brain using things like MRIs. Can you talk about that? Are there sections of the brain that seem to be more concerned when we're having musical fantasies?
Yeah. So this is something we were really excited about, because once we'd done all this behavioral work that I was describing, where we'd gotten people to describe these stories in response to these unfamiliar excerpts, we now had this kind of ground truth. Like, we knew what the story that any particular excerpt was likely to trigger in a listener. And that gave us a new way to look at these kind of meaning-making processes in the brain scanner. So what we could do was bring people in and play them either the musical excerpts or play them spoken recordings of the stories that we knew those excerpts were likely to trigger. So now what we have is a picture of what's happening in the brain when they're imagining a story in response to, like, a verbal recounting of that story. And we can compare that with what's happening when they're imagining a story while they're listening to a musical excerpt.
And the results are?
Yeah, and the result there is that this region called the default mode network that is really important and comes online when you're not engaged in a particular fixed task. So when your brain starts, your mind starts wandering.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're kind of like thinking what might happen tomorrow or replaying a thing that happened to you in the past. So we really see for particular musical excerpts, particular patterns of activation in the default mode network of the brain. So we really see those signatures of these excerpt-specific stories that are emerging as people listen.
You also write
a...
sounds like fun.
That was fun just because so much before we had that kind of ground truth of a matched verbal story, we weren't really able to tap into those higher level meaning making processes with music in terms of neuroimaging. So that was kind of an exciting step for us.
We're almost out of time, but I want to mention that you also write a lot about the possibilities using AI to analyze the data.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And in some ways, you know, tools from machine learning and natural language processing helped us take something as kind of squishy as free response descriptions of stories and, you know, crunch them and make sense of them in this kind of quantitative way. So that was really exciting. But then there's this whole other side of how AI might play into musical practices in the future. And the book tries to kind of speculate about what that might look like.
We are completely out of time. My guest tonight is Elizabeth Margulis. She's a professor of music and director of the Music Cognition Lab at Princeton University. And we've been talking about her book. It's a wild read. It's really fascinating. Transported. The Everyday Magic of Musical Daydreams. Elizabeth, it's been a pleasure.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.